Hey, did you know this podcast has a Patreon? At patreon.com/scarysundayscaries, you can support the podcast for as little as a dollar and get early access to episodes and join in on community posts with all the other hosts and me. patreon.com/scarysundayscaries. Get out there and do it. Thanks.
Yeah, and even just my one foray back into Dallas in May, I went for a jog. I think like a couple hours after we hung out, I had to sober up a little.
Sunday Scaries.
I'm sorry.
No, it's not your fault. I was laughing because I was like, oh, I had all these plans. And I was like, no, this is better. I should probably relax. I went for a jog to kind of sweat out the liquor. And holy cow. I was like, I sweat out everything. That was like a full body drench.
Oh, yeah, it'll do it. And that was in May, too. It was nice out in May.
Yeah. Now it's like so hot, don't leave your house kind of weather out there.
I don't know if I sound a little sick. I'm getting over a cold too, so it's like it's a perfect.
I couldn't tell, honestly.
Yeah, how you doing?
I'm good. We're having a good summer out here in LA. I have like a regular job now. I don't save lives at all. It's pretty great.
Do I do the intro? Like, is an intro good? It's Sunday Scaries. Yeah. It's a podcast about horror movies where each week we take the edge off each episode. Let's do that. It's Sunday Scaries. It's a podcast about horror movies where each episode. We take the edge off by diving deep into a particular scary movie and finding connections between that movie and other movies within the genre. These are our dead air sessions where we talk about current events and other topics within the industry, media, film, other things like that. A little more looser format. And I'm hanging out here in Dallas, and you're out there in pre-apocalypse Los Angeles.
I don't know. They think it's just apocalypse Los Angeles.
Straight up mid-apocalypse Los Angeles.
Yeah,
and we're hanging out. We're talking about Maxine today. We're talking about. Did you see Long Legs yet?
I didn't. I had to catch up on work yesterday, so it was like truly disappointing. I have heard all the takes, but I haven't heard the story, like any plot spoilers.
I mean, I posted my joking Letterboxd review, and I've had some conversations about it with the group that we went to go see it with at Texas Theater on Sunday.
Yeah,
and I've got thoughts. Maybe we'll save that for another time. But
I'm gonna make an effort on Wednesday on my day off to go. Mm-hmm. I am to recap just our movie viewing habits. I am an AMC Stubbs member now. I have abandoned the Draft House. Which is ironic to me because I have more accessibility to the Alamo Draft House than you do currently, and there is one in the entire city of Los Angeles. So there's something like deeply ironic about me abandoning the Draft House at the same time that the Draft House abandoned you.
Well, you're doing it in solidarity with us out here, I guess.
Yeah, it's a slight protest. That and there's just free parking at most of the AMCs.
Yeah. And for those of you that haven't heard, Alamo Draft House, the franchisee that sort of has been running all of the Alamo Draft Houses in North Texas, like half a dozen, I guess we had three here in Dallas. We had one in Denton. We had a Richardson Draft House. We had a few more, Colleyville, I guess. And all of those that shuttered their doors, what was that, a month and a half ago?
Out of the blue. People were showing up to work to find out that the theater was closed.
Yeah, what a bummer. And it turns out that his name is Bill, right? I forget the name of the franchisee who ran the North Texas Draft Houses. But apparently they were filing for bankruptcy and in the course of that had decided to close all the doors of all of the North Texas Draft Houses, kind of complaining that essentially movie attendance since COVID and during the strikes has been down, using that as sort of the excuse, I guess. I don't know what you call it that. But that was whiplash, though, that week to week. So, you know, we found out that our beloved Draft House was closing, and then directly afterward, Sony is purchased Draft House now, the entire franchise, right? And now owns them across North America. I don't know.
We're a little nervous. I think it's good. I'm a little nervous, but I'm always a little nervous when large corporations buy like your favorite like little movie theater chain.
Draft House is special because of you can tell whenever you go to a screening at Alamo Draft House, they do so much work in sort of the, I don't know how big of a, like a little studio they have on the side where they produce all of the shorts and all of the cut together material that is specific to, you know, whatever big blockbuster or large release is coming out at a time. I mean, I don't know how many they do a year too, because it seems like they tailor a unique presentation, a pre-screening sort of, you know, montage of old school, like deep cut movies, as well as sort of like for all the Marvel movies, they do like catch up sort of mini documentaries on what's going on in the superhero universe, or similarly to any like any horror movie, they do background on, you know, the inspiration for, you know, folk horror or slashers or whatever's going on in the particular movie that you're watching. I don't know who does all that work or how much like effort goes into that or how big of a team it is, but it just it's something special and something really amazing, the programming that they do. Aside from that, the programming for the screenings of movies from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and in all in theme over the course of summers and falls, where you can go and week to week watch, you know, all of the James Bond movies, or watch, you know, like every shark movie that came out in the past 40 years, or they'll do runs of Spielberg, they'll do runs of Star Wars and stuff.
I feel like every Pride Month they do the Birdcage. Like it's like everything else changes, but it's Pride Month, so we're watching the Birdcage, damn it.
Yeah, that's all to say that Outlaw Draft House is fantastic, and it has a very special place, like,
yeah,
you know, in everybody's hearts.
If if you live in like anywhere that's basically not LA or New York, like it's just very hard to find like a repertory theater. Repertory meaning like, you know, they screen movies that aren't just like most recently released. Like you could catch like consistent. Oh, it's like the Cinema con Nosotros that Bianca does. Like it's hard to find a movie theater that will have someone who programs, you know, older Spanish-speaking films that a one person kind of puts together. Mm-hmm. And the Draft House did like a really good job of that, and so it had like this flavor to it that we all kind of like loved having in our lives, because you could go to like parties, you could do like a 10-course meal at a Titanic themed screening. Like that's just the thing they would do. It's just like the experience of going to the movies is what matters. And obviously after COVID, it was just like a long slide descent into a very, very difficult position. But they are on a franchise model, so I always want to separate, like, yeah, the Draft Houses in Dallas, DFW at large, kind of shuttered, but it's not, like, representative of the entire company.
Yeah, and that's what's interesting, too, is, like, the spirit of a love for cinema is kind of, like, what is captured there, right? Both there, and we're lucky enough here in Dallas to have Texas Theater, where Bianca works, where we can go and we kind of have that on demand as well, where we get to go and we have, you know, they do programming there, they do Tuesday Night Trash, they do all these other like random, you know, they'll do screenings throughout the year of stuff that you don't normally have a chance to see on a big screen. And that was kind of what, on a more, like you said, a more franchise level, that's what Alamo was able to do, where they were bringing in, you know, it was like watching programming that was put together by your friend who loves movies, right? It's that sort of the sentiment, the pathos that was like that was brought to that. And it's interesting because this kind of happened already previously, right? I remember like in right after the Draft House closings, the news stories came out about how back in the day, like it was a few years ago too, where a similar thing essentially happened down in Austin, where the, you know, some of the OG like Draft Houses and the ones that were surrounding the Austin area, after, you know, the original, the one that, like, you know, Tim Lee had founded, they were having a similar financial issue where they were going bankrupt or shuttering their doors, and then Tim Lee went in and just bought them back, essentially, from the franchisee. And so we kind of wondered if something similar was going to happen to the North Texas Draft Houses, but then out of the blue, I guess, I don't know how, if it seemed like it happened so fast, they had to have been waiting for this to happen, or somebody was really, like, had their eyes on this franchise and was just ready and eager from Sony to come and scoop it up as property.
And most notably, this is kind of like an addendum to what we're talking about, but Sony doesn't have a streaming service, right? Like everyone kind of talks about the streaming wars, and I love this metaphor because I've heard Sony be described as an arms dealer rather than an arms manufacturer. They're like, we're just going to license our content and stay out of the streaming race. So I'm wondering if Sony saw an opportunity, especially after they rolled back the Paramount decrees during the Trump presidency, which was something everyone kind of like, you know, was super nervous about. The Paramount decrees essentially prevented movie studios from owning movie theaters. And in like a dystopian world version of this, there would be like, you would have to go to AMC if you wanted to watch Paramount movies, or you'd have to go to Regal if you wanted to watch Disney movies, but you couldn't see both at one place. And so it creates a lot of, it would potentially create a lot of consumer chaos. Obviously, they rolled back the Paramount decrees. That didn't happen. It's not like AMC got bought out by like one of the studios and is now only showing studio films. it kind of doesn't quite work that way. Like, they still need to make, the theaters have to make money. But this was one of the most notable purchases after the Paramount decrease, was Sony buying out Alamo Drafthouse. And so that, coupled with the fact that they don't have a streaming service, makes me think that maybe they are looking for kind of a repertory outlet to, like, soft launch films. So they would have, like, their own little theater chain. They can kind of, it's kind of like a test kitchen, but for movies or movie screenings.
That is, like, the most optimistic perspective on it, right? Is the idea that, like, Sony is like, well, fuck the streaming, we're gonna, like, release ours straight to theaters. And, you know, it's, there's something sort of really cool about that, the idea that they, you know, supporting the cinema experience and the idea of going to the movie theater. But that's giving a lot of credit. That's doing a lot of work for Sony, I feel like.
And in the press release, they seem to think that, like, the Drafthouse is, like, the reigning champion of, like, movie theater experiences. Like, it's not enough to just go to a movie now. A lot of people are like, oh, it has to be an event, like the Barbenheimer effect, so to speak. And so they kind of think, like, well, the Drafthouse has been trying to make their own kind of, like, Barbenheimer effect. Go to a 10-course dining, like, Titanic-themed dining experience, and then, like, tell all your friends about it kind of thing. And so, like, I remember in the press announcement, they're like, it's not just a theater division, it's, like, a theatrical experience division. Which, you know, it's two words, so maybe I'm making a lot out of nothing, but I do think, like, Sony wants some of that. That being said, they are a massive corporation. Alamo is, like, not as big, and Alamo has a lot of restructuring and debt to pay off. So the first thing we're going to start seeing is, like, slashing budgets. Like, the food menu is going to get down to, like, a burger and chicken tendies or something. And it's going to be, like, the frozen tendies you can get at a grocery store or something. That's, like, my worst possible version of this.
Yeah, it's interesting because you wonder how, like, especially from the way the franchises worked, I assume, too, and, like, the way that, like, they were allowed to manage themselves. Like, there was already, and not to say that there weren't already issues, right, with Alamo Drafthouse, you know, kind of famously, the Drafthouses both here in North Texas and down in Austin had multiple occasions of employees, you know, staging some worker sort of sit-ins or localized strikes and everything, due to, like, working conditions and, sort of issues that they sort of identified with the company itself and with its labor practices. And so they're inheriting a little bit of baggage there already when it comes to, you know, operations and stuff.
I mean, they're definitely licensing out to, like, anyone and everyone. Madam Web was, like, the number two hit on Netflix for about a week, just out of, like, I think the general public's morbid curiosity. My little sister was like, have you seen this Madam Web movie? And I was like, no, I've seen the trailers. And she was like, I have so many opinions. All my friends and I wanted to watch it just because of, like, all the TikToks that we saw of, like, Dakota Johnson's interviews or, like, Sydney Sweeney's, like, outfit displays, like, all these kinds of, like, strange things that Sony is like, sure, we're on Netflix, like, we're gonna dominate Netflix for a little while.
Yeah, it seems like each new successive Spider-Man property that Sony tries to release is trying to beat the previous one for, like, title of the worst Spider-Man movie ever made.
Kraven the Hunter is coming. So
I'm excited for Kraven the
Hunter. Hold on to your hats, folks.
I'm an Aaron Taylor Johnson fan, though, man.
You're a stan?
Oh, God, I love that man so much. I want him to be the next James Bond. We've talked about this. This is the conversation. It's like, of the potential Bonds that are coming down the pipeline, after Bullet Train, I was like, man, I think he's got what it takes to be a sick James Bond, with or without the mustache. Like, it's looking good. And Kraven the Hunter looks sick too. As a 1990s Spider-Man, you know, obsessive, I watched that cartoon, you know, throughout my childhood, and Kraven the Hunter was a really fun character in that. And I think, like, I don't know, I'll watch it. I'll definitely, like, check it out. The trailer looks cool. And it's really hard too. It's gonna be bloody.
Yeah, so you can imagine Sony's, like, excited that people like Travis are very excited about their movies. And I can guarantee you, about 2 months after Kraven the Hunter goes out, anyone who did not feel motivated to make that theatrical move is going to catch it on, like, Netflix.
Yeah, which is fine.
To each their own. I'm kind of done poo-pooing the, like, I'll just wait till it goes to streaming mentality.
Yeah.
I'm just going to do me. Like, they're going to do them, I'm going to do me. I'm a Stubbs guy. But being a Stubbs guy, the rewards, it's like the Drafthouse thing. Like, the rewards build, I get to go. Like, Stubbs, please sponsor this podcast.
I like AMC. I like whenever we want to go see a movie that has like the like me and Blake were talking about this about things that are filmed or recorded in Dolby Digital Surround Sound or like in IMAX and everything. Obviously, we went to go see Oppenheimer at AMC. We went to go see a couple of things like in IMAX, and that's usually like you know where we'll go to have the best theoretically like technically best movie viewing experience. And so I don't poo-poo AMC. I just hate driving to North Park to go watch movies.
That's fair. We have our own. We actually it's imagine if like half the AMCs were all at North Parks. Like there's like four different shopping complexes across LA that are essentially larger, fancier, stuffier, bigger, busier like North Parks. Ooh. So it's like yeah, it's chaos. The Grove, don't go there. If I have to give anyone advice in LA, like don't hang out at the Grove. It's a the parking is a nightmare. It's a lot of people. But, oh my God, I just like threw myself off topic here. I don't remember what I was going to say. I think largely we can agree that that Sony is dealing some arms, but they are vehemently against building their own streaming service. They just don't see a need for it.
Yeah. I think the, I don't know if anybody's won the streaming wars yet, but I already feel like there's the fatigue in trying to pump stuff through streaming is already kind of present. Do you know anybody that's watching House of the Dragon right now? I haven't caught keeping up.
I do have a friend. I have a friend who is big on House of the Dragon. She's a very passionate person, mm-hmm. And so it's kind of great. I love like living vicariously through them. They seem to love like everything they watch, or like hate everything they watch. So I have like, oh, cool. I have all the takes I need. But I kind of like abandoned ship. I was like, you know what? Game of Thrones is done. I don't think I need to like revisit this world. Like see this through to the very end. I'm happy. I'm like trying to watch some shows, but the more TV I watch, the less movies I watch. Like it's a directly proportional relationship, and I'm just trying to like watch more movies. Yeah, same. I really am.
Yeah, we are lucky enough here in Dallas to have Texas Theater and the programming that they do. Oak Cliff Film Festival wrapped up last month. It was really fun. We saw a lot of really great movies. Saw the second film, the sophomore movie by Jane Schoenberg. I saw the TV Glow, which was really fun.
That's such a good movie.
I think it's on streaming now. Have you gotten to see it?
I did. I actually went with some friends. The beauty of the Stubbs membership, baby.
Hey.
I went and saw it with some friends on a Friday afternoon, and I honestly, we should just talk about the summer season. I don't want to bog us down too far, but my biggest takes, the best movies I've seen so far this summer are Challengers and I Saw the TV Glow. Those are like my big two.
Nice. I still haven't seen Challengers.
I mean, Dune 2 is amazing, obviously, but I'm like going for like summer season slash the launch into summer.
Mm-hmm.
And Maxine's kind of like a mid-tier rank. I think we'll get to Maxine in general here, but as far as like I was very high, this whole summer has been like I was really excited about this, and then it turned around and I was like I feel very like okay about everything.
Yeah, I saw the TV Glow kind of came out of nowhere. I was actually looking for. I mean, I saw that it was getting released, and I saw that Jane had made it. And who we met? Were you at that film? That was that one that we were both at Oak Cliff Film Festival when?
I think that was the one I worked.
Yeah, when We're All Going to the World's Fair was released.
Yeah,
And we got to speak to Jane. You know, like I remember sharing a cigarette with them out in front of Texas Theater, and talking about We're All Going to the World's Fair and how interesting. Like, I mean, they spoke about the movie too afterward, and about the experience. You know, growing up in sort of our generation of the early days of the Wild West of the internet, when it was the chat rooms were much less regulated, and you had these weird things of, you know, you'd be a preteen or young teenager online talking in a chat room to some 40-year-old person, you know, across the country. And the ramifications of that, and then integrating that into some cool sci-fi elements and a YouTube challenge as the premise for We're All Going to the World's Fair, which is a really interesting sort of trippy.
But you like you don't get to see stuff like that quite easily unless you like live in LA or New York or have like a Texas theater or a draft house. But
yeah, or in a film festival that will screen it, which was and it was cool to see this the second film coming around where Jane is now working with A24 money and production. You know, it's super cool. And but that movie I saw, the TV Glow, had no less indie and sort of like strange and puzzling flair to it. It definitely reminded me of those, you know, it's self-referential, and there's a big meta content within it of the type of shows like Are You Afraid of the Dark or So Weird or Goosebumps, those low budget sort of cable television, kind of sci-fi kids' version of Twilight Zone, you know, shows or episodes where there's all, you know, these unique individual bottle episodes or some of them that have continuity to them. And that was one of the funnest things, I think, about that movie, which if you were to summarize I Saw the TV Glow, it's I've been telling people it's a, you know, it's a cool sort of sci-fi trans-allegory identity sort of thing, and down a rabbit hole style of, like, you know, Mandy or other kind of mind-fuckery sort of stuff. And within it, it's a coming-of-age thing about two queer teenagers, and then this other world that they sort of live within the movie, which is this sort of sci-fi television show called Pink. What is it called?
The Pink Opaque.
The Pink Opaque, yeah.
Yep.
And within that is the fun thing of having to produce an entire show within a movie that Jane did, where it's like they get all those interesting cutaways and inserts from the show itself, and the goofy effects and puppetry and stuff that go on within it that sort of takes you in and out of this sort of kind of uncanny world.
And it is in and of itself, it is very horrific. There's like horror with, so it's like explicitly a horror film,
right?
It just has that A24 stamp of like slow burn melodrama mixed with like horrific either ideas or like moments of violence or just like kind of like shock and awe in some senses.
And it's the Lynchian thing too of the unsettling. You don't know what is real and what is not real, and how I think the thing that movies like that do well is playing with tone in such a way where it's, you know, there are comedic moments and very sweet moments within the movie, but then there are other moments where you don't know if you're supposed to feel good or not, and then that kind of puts you on a razor's edge that, you know, can feel horrific, and it feels unsettling and uncanny in a way that I think is very effective too. 'Cause it is about, like, the, you know, the childhood and then early adolescence of two people who are struggling deeply with their mental health and identity and relationship with reality.
Yeah.
The two main actors who kind of play the adult versions of the characters do a really great job of sort of capturing that, the unease of anybody who's had sort of a maybe a repressed childhood or a repressed deeply codependent friendship or something throughout your adolescence that, you know, evolves into adulthood. It's interesting. There's a lot there. There's a lot to unravel with that movie, I think.
I agree. There's been, as far as like the horror of the season goes, you know, I'm only like maybe I'm through like half of what has been like released or put out there, or is like, you know, getting top billing. I did see like the Sydney Sweeney Immaculate, right, which was like its own quite opposite of like I Saw the TV Glow. You're like,
yeah,
it's very clear what's going on right now, and it builds entirely off of plot.
And similarly, The First Omen too.
The First Omen. I love how Hollywood does that. They'll be like, we have two movies that feel similar, and somehow we don't plan it, but they come out around the same time.
Right.
Like The Illusionist and The Prestige came out around the same time, and everyone kept confusing the two.
Yeah.
And now this with like a woman joins a convent that may or may not be spooky.
Yeah.
And they're pregnant. You're like, oh, is this the same movie? They are not the same movie.
They are not, yeah. The First Omen. You saw The First Omen as well?
I missed it. It's on streaming. So
yes,
for anyone who wants to catch up, you can watch it on Hulu, I believe.
I really enjoyed that one as an entry into the... I always bill the first, like, the Omen movies, the whole, you know, each, all of them together as a property, along with Rosemary's Baby, right? Because it's sort of a similar kind of, like, you can put those... That's a really interesting double or triple feature, is to put those together. And Rosemary's Baby kind of, I think, encapsulates a lot of the inherent fear of what goes on in the premise of like a satanic cult bringing about, you know, the Antichrist or something. Rosemary's Baby is definitely sort of like a progenitor of that in many ways. And then the Omen movies kind of inherit that. And then this, as an installment, a prequel to the Omen movies, really like harps on the sort of the inherent fear of and like the very, very real terror of an institution like the Catholic Church having control over like women's bodies too, which is like,
yeah,
really disturbing and unsettling, especially given like, you know, the state of affairs in the world and country we live in.
There is, to be fair too, there is kind of a separation from like the horror, like there's like pregnancy horror, and then there is like the demonic cult next door kind of horror, and even like Rosemary's Baby kind of separates those two, and now we're starting to see like some of these themes get merged in these movies, like The First Omen, and Immaculate to some degree, is a little bit more of like the body horror of what, you know, can happen in pregnancy horror, but also kind of that I like to say, like, the satanic cult next door has like conceived a demon in your belly or something.
Yeah,
and they two like do dovetail neatly together. I mean, they sound like they're both playing on the same idea, but I do think some of the body horror of pregnancy stuff gets kind of like subdued in the younger versions of all these kinds of films.
I will say The First Omen, the director actually kind of noted how in getting past the regulator, when they were trying to rate that movie, right, and give it an R rating, the things that they had to remove from the movie to give it at least an R rating were really interesting too. There's one particular scene when you're talking about body horror and pregnancy birthing horror, that the director thought was very interesting that the ratings committee had to have removed, because it features some organs essentially that it seemed more about like a fear of displaying like female anatomy rather than the actual horror that was going on, that she sort of like took umbrage with. She was, you know, noting that the people who were doing the ratings seemed to have more issue with like the female anatomy than they did the actual like demon that was present in the shot too. Which is,
well, let me just like add a little sauce on that too. Remember when they made Knocked Up sauce, and it was like, you know, it was a little like shocked that they would even bother to show like something like that, but somehow it got passed, and now that movie's R-rated and comedic and is like funny, but this movie's R-rated and scary.
Yeah.
And we can't do that. You're like, what's the line here?
Yeah. One thing that, like, man, that makes me think of one of the callbacks to Oak Cliff Film Festival, a film that I, one of the documentary films that we, I went to go watch with one of my friends, was a documentary about, have you ever heard of Bunny Yeager before?
No, I have not.
She's a, she's a famous pinup model photographer from the 60s and 70s who kind of basically, like, pioneered the style of photography of pinup models. She worked with like Playboy and stuff, but she herself was also like a pinup model. So she was in front of and behind the camera, sort of learning, working with models and how to photograph them. But through her career is really interesting, because you see sort of like the evolution of like what becomes what the market is like demanding, like once like Playboy magazines and stuff and Hustler gets like rolled out, about like what, you know, the more and more salacious things, where it starts out with pinup models who are clothed mostly, or like maybe topless at the worst, and then moving southward, you know, geographically, as far as like when Hustler comes out, things get a lot more graphic, and how her career kind of took a turn at that point, because she didn't see like that as rewarding or as like, you know, as respectful of the models that she was like photographing. Sorry, that just popped in my mind. It was Bunny Yeager. Watch the Bunny Yeager documentary. It's really good. It's an okay documentary, but it's a really fun sort of peek into that industry. But yeah, First Omen, good as far as summer horror goes. And then Long Legs, we probably need to set aside a whole different conversation for Long Legs once you watch it, because that movie has been marketed as the scariest film of the decade. And having seen it, I won't spoil too much, but I don't know if it really lives up to that, you know.
I'm just really glad we're talking about movie marketing more often.
I think
it doesn't play into as many conversations as it should.
That's really the real theme of this podcast. That's how we should start introducing it, is, hey, do you want to talk about movie marketing? This is a podcast for you, because that's a large part of our conversation a lot of the time, I feel like.
You know, I have some guests who could speak better to that professionally, although I don't know if they'd want to. But I could definitely say that I've been given insight. I've peeked behind the curtain anecdotally, and it's very interesting. It's a very interesting and kind of petty world sometimes.
I think Long Legs is the most recent example. Again, when we get into it, like, I'm interested to talk about that one, because the marketing for that movie is fantastic, and the movie's good.
Hey, it's Travis. Just jumping in here in the middle of the episode to say thank you for listening. And if you guys like what you hear, please feel free to tag us on social media at Scary Sunday Scaries. It's one of the best things you can do for the podcast. It really helps us get more followers and interact with you guys. So we hope we hear from you guys soon. Thanks.
How about Maxine? How do you feel like that was marketed?
Big. It was like gonna be the big summer horror movie. They were like, here's the antidote to all your cheesy blockbusters. Like, we're gonna give you the big final climax to the trilogy, pun intended. Climax to the trilogy that Ty West started out, that we all love and hold dearly, and it's gonna be this, like, you know, bigger budgets, bigger set pieces. Maxine is now, like, she's in control. She's confident. And it's in the 80s, which is what everyone loves doing right
it's
now.
Big,
is being
bombastic,
in the 80s.
It's groovy. Yeah,
yeah, I felt like it was kind of a blockbuster without being called a blockbuster. It's like what I imagine if, like, you know, Friday the 13th Part 4 probably came out in the summer, and they were like, this movie is not like all the other movies.
I feel like it was promising a lot. It had a lot to live up to, especially, like you said, being the cap to the trilogy of Ty West's X and Pearl, and the final sort of, like, the final destination of this character that Mia Goth has sort of both, like, in the prequel playing multiple characters and the identity of Mia Goth as a Scream Queen herself, and sort of, like, the way that, again, so we'll get into it in a second, but, like, the meta nature, that way that fits into the movie and, like, the character of Maxine. It was promising big, and whether or not it delivered on that is, I don't know, I guess we can
As far as viewing experiences go, I mean, I wrote an essay on Letterboxd, so if anyone wants to hear, like, the full insane thoughts I have, you can read it in all of its inane and stupid glory on Letterboxd. But when I went to watch Maxine, I made Mary-Kate, as in I convinced her. I didn't, like, strap her to a chair and make her watch, but we watched X and Pearl within about 3 or 4 days of each other, and then Maxine 3 or 4 days after Pearl. I watched Pearl with some friends. I was taking notes. I've seen them. Well, obviously, we've talked about this, but I've seen them. So I was watching and taking a lot of notes, kind of like, oh, if I were in film school, what would I write? Mm-hmm. But when I watched Pearl with friends, it was kind of fun because everyone was really confused for the first hour. They were like, at what point does this turn into a horror movie? And you kind of get to be the one that's like, shh,
wait.
Like, just wait. Yeah.
It does,
so I got to watch the previous
turn,
two.
Yeah.
It does. And I watched the first two, and then I watched Maxine, and I can actually say with a little confidence there are some similar sins between all three movies.
Right.
It's just that Maxine kind of was conceived at a different time. They made they made X and they made Pearl literally back-to-back on the same sets and everything. So those two are just going to feel more cohesive, and this is like, you know, something that's done after the success of both of these movies. So
yeah.
Maxine has a lot to live up to, and also, like, a completely different world almost to live in.
It is. It's definitely much more removed from the production of the first two movies, which, yeah, Pearl essentially was written simultaneously as X, as like a character exercise in sort of diving into the background of the main antagonist of the first movie, X. And that's kind of like how Pearl was conceived in general, was Mia Goth exploring what it was, this, you know, the slasher villain essentially in X, and then they developed an entire script out of that. I do want to real quick. I was reading some articles and, like, watching some other websites do write ups and talk about X, Pearl, and Maxine. And whoever did the video for Screen Rant talking about Maxine and doesn't know how to pronounce Ty West's name, that's
what they say.
They said T West.
Interesting.
Yeah, I was like,
are we saying it wrong? We're not saying it wrong.
It's, no, it's Ty. Yeah. So the main thing I think that was interesting about your write up too is this idea of what all three movies do in different four different eras and different subgenres of horror, or just film in general, is they're all period pieces, but they're also stylistic period pieces, and the choice by Ty West to try to capture the moment in movie making from each one of those eras, technically, and through the structure and, like, actual composition of the movie, where X functions as sort of an homage to the classic sort of grindhouse slasher, like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and that era of filmmaking, where even the way it's cut together is very much in the style of, you know, like Tobe Hooper's Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where it's sort of slapdash. There's, you know, the general cadence and, like, structure of the plot is pretty similar. You have, you know, it starts out in a car in a road trip in the middle of Texas. You know, you get to this farmhouse, which is the set piece for all the horrible things that happen, and then you have your beat by beat sort of, you know, taking out of the main cast, right? And then they even have of course, all of the different little sort of Easter eggs in there. They have, you know, a reference to Psycho in the first movie with the car sinking into the lake. Even the appearance of the house looks like, you know, the house from Psycho or from Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And then the second movie, Pearl, definitely has much, it's a Technicolor sort of throwback to the golden age of cinema, right, of The Wizard of Oz, or, you know, in the very early stages of color film. And it's, so it's hyper-saturated, hyper-stylized. It's almost, you know, it's a musical almost in some parts. It's, there's dance numbers. And then, like, laced throughout that are the slasher elements as well. And it's very sort of big and theatrical in its tone, ending with a 10-minute single-shot monologue from Mia Goth, where she really gets to indulge in that character and sort of just really deliver on that premise. And I think your Letterboxd review definitely hits us on this nail on the head of what this movie does, what Ty West is doing with the 80s movie. That's something that I think is really great about Maxine is, again, the way it's cut together, the way it feels very of the time of the 80s, both in the music and the editing and even the types of shots that are getting used. It feels like something that you would see from Carpenter. Like many moments of it felt like They Live in the style of shots that they have.
It essentially, like, honors and is in and of itself an 80s kind of, like, classic, almost at the heyday of 80s horror, like, horror movie. There's, like, influences of Giallo. Like, I kind of think,
the,
like,
Giallo,
you know,
is great, yeah.
I think, like, this one would, like, you know, hold up next to, like, a Nightmare on Elm Street 4 or a, like, you know, like, it's before, it's after the franchises are burning and they're kind of, like, somewhere in the 3 to 6 range on a bunch of these, and people are like, this is really fun. It hasn't quite turned into, like, the full-blown cash grab that people don't quite remember of it, but it's, like, living in this world where, like, now it has an entrenched language, all these, like, specific things that have to happen. These are the movies, and Maxine fits firmly within the same space that, like, established the rules that a lot of horror fans like to,
right,
like, judge horror movies off of. They're like, okay, well, the virgin always dies. Well, yeah, the virgin dies in, you know, or the virgin always lives. The virgin lives in Nightmare on Elm Street 1 through 6. So of course they would think that. They've had 6 movies to see that.
Yeah, or the giallo thing of, like, the giallo influence was, like, really impressive to me as well. And, like, that's something I didn't, like, talk about. But the gloved hand where it's like, oh, you're never allowed to see the killer until the end of the movie. You can only see their disembodied, like, leather hand going and, like, murdering people off screen, essentially.
And, like, like any, like, Dario Argento, any of the giallo, like, highbrow, like, any of the classics, there's still, like, a lot of, like, plotting that just happens because it has to happen. Mm-hmm. You're like, why is this happening now? And they're like, because scary.
Yeah.
So I think, like, my Letterboxd review, in short, essentially is that, like, it is so much the thing that it loves and homages that people are, like, disappointed. But I would argue, like, they're misremembering the things that they loved about the other movies.
Right.
It's like, if you were to watch, like, Nightmare on Elm Street 3 through 7, you'd be like, this is cheesy. Whereas this is, like, fun, but not that scary. And also, like, I can totally see all the things, like, coming. A lot of the, like, complaints people would have about Maxine, they have about some of these other movies, they just, like, those movies are older now, and we get to, like, fondly remember the mistakes rather than strategically point them out. So, like, Maxine is just kind of a product of what it's trying to be, what it's trying to mimic, and what it's trying to, like, show, like, no, we love these things. Look at, like, what makes it great.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing, too, is, like, I think in retrospect, like, the experience of watching this movie and sort of, like, having very high expectations for how they were going to, because the other thing, too, is at the end of X, when the character of Maxine takes off, you kind of have no concept of where that story goes from there. Like, it's such an open-ended, like, anything could happen in that movie. And it's interesting seeing them thematically, too, try to bring back around the underlying sort of, mission of both X and Pearl, which is sort of this obsession with fame, right? And the refrain, like the mantra that Maxine, you know, constantly tells herself is like, I will not accept a life that I do not deserve. Right. And this idea of sort of the self-aggrandizing nature of an obsession with fame and like, what does that mean? Whether it's that, or if it's Pearl where it's, you know, like I'm a star, I'm a fucking star. Right. An obsession with the need to be acknowledged and be like, and be given the fame that the main character believes that they deserve. And then that kind of, like, and the way that the movie ends, too, with, like, the Elizabeth Debicki character, the director, sort of kind of ushering Maxine and sort of, like, guiding her into the final role, almost, like, both, like, it within the movie universe that they're creating, the movie within the movie that they create within this, and then also the character herself, and how that sort of, like, flips itself back around on, like, what Maxine is and what she represents as far as, like, the what will you do, you know, when your obsession with fame or your obsession with, you know, the drive to be this person, like, where does that take you? Like, what are you willing to, who are you willing to kill for that, essentially?
Yeah, it's very interesting to me. You know, I have one thematic question I want to start asking. Obviously, this is, like, on the Dead Air sesh, so it's just, like, just the short end dive, not the deep dive. But I'm always, like, what is the fear present? Like, what's the concrete thing we're supposed to be, like, scared of? Or the abstract thing? Like, in X, for example, we can easily say, like, oh, one of the fears is growing old and being sexually impotent is, mm-hmm. like, kind of how terrifying the idea of getting old. And in Pearl, the fear of, you know, living
a boring life.
Boring life. Or living in, like, utter ignominy. I don't know a better word for that. That was so bougie. Like, living completely unknown to the world and, like, having almost no consequence, feeling like you had no impact on the world. And Maxine, like, I want to know what is, like, the fear here.
I think that what the character encapsulates is sort of, like, what happens when you abandon all else in the pursuit of your dream or your drive, right? Like, what kind of monster do you turn into? Because that's sort of, I feel like, what they're sort of trying to put on display here, right? And then also pairing that with, like, you know, sorry, we're spoiling this movie, by the way, but, like, you know, the ending of the movie, too, of bringing back her father and, like, the idea of, like, his proposition that, you know, he created, even the sort of monster that she becomes eventually by the end of the movie, right, where she's, like, murdered a few people and, you know, now is, like, sort of an indomitable, you know, movie star that will do whatever it takes to, like, you know, reach her goal. And he tries to take credit for that and finds himself, you know, compares himself to her and is the idea that there's of a similar ilk, right? It's like, when is the pursuit of your dreams, like, going too far? And when have you crossed the line where you're, you know, like, past a point of no return or something? Which I feel like the 80s really works for as well, right? Like, there's something about, like, the coke-addled sort of, like, relentless sort of energy that comes from that era that feels uncontrolled and, you know, unmanageable,
like,
or something.
I was just, like, I'm utterly shocked that Maxine Minx doesn't have, like, a horrible, like, hole in her septum and, like, a bad nasal drip after, like, abusing cocaine. There's a great scene where she's, like, in her dressing room and she, like, opens a cookie jar full of cocaine.
Yeah.
It's just, like, an actual, like, gallon-sized jar of cocaine. You're
sometimes,
like, Jesus.
You don't have a cookie jar full of cocaine at your house?
I do not. I barely have a cookie jar full of cookies in my house. But it's just one of those, like, classic 80s things, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's such a – and then obviously, like, the real fear, like, there's a serial killer. Like, a serial killer is super interesting to us, which Pearl is a serial killer. And she Pearl, the character, is a serial killer. In Pearl, it's the story of how Pearl becomes a serial killer kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that is an interesting question, though, that you pose, though, of, like, there's the thematic element of the movie of, like, all right, what do we fear for the character? Like, what are we afraid of for this character, for them to experience? And then, yeah, the actual thing that, like, scares us about the experience of watching the movie, which is the shock and terror, like, the body horror of seeing people get murdered on screen, which is where this movie kind of, like, walks the line, right, of being, you know, as the bookend to a horror franchise, right? Like, it's not really, like, a scary movie, right? It's just more of kind of an action movie.
Mary Kate was like, this is a thriller. I don't know if it's a horror. And that's, we had another conversation for a different day about, like, the border between horror movies and other movies and what that looks like.
This is a conversation that we have a lot, I feel like, about, especially with crime thrillers, right? Where there's a very blurry line between, like, when does like a crime thriller become a horror movie? And, like, you know, like, David Fincher walks that line, right, with Zodiac or Seven, movies that are based in reality and based around, you know, the procedural crime drama, but when the content of the crimes or, like, the actual, like, the evidence of the murders of that are hinted at becomes so gruesome that it sort of gets into the, like, territory of horror. This movie is operating on sort of a similar vein, but like it does have those giallo elements of witnessing on-screen slasher horror elements that kind of still try to tug it back in that direction. But even those, because they're so stylized and so fun, you find yourself just sort of enjoying, the action and throughout this movie. And I don't know if very much of it like really qualifies as horror, other than sort of kind of what we're talking about, which is the emotional center of like, oh shit, like what is this lady gonna do next, kind of thing. And like, it's like that thing of like.
That and like the pretty rough violence from time to time.
Yeah.
There's a couple kills you're like, yeah, this is a horror movie. I get that.
It's kind of like
yeah. It definitely does a lot of heavy lifting in like the more violent oriented scenes. And then there's a lot of plotting in the middle. You're kind of like, oh, this feels a little different.
Yeah. There's a kill, man, though. The one alleyway kill is fantastic. There's that
happens like early on too.
Yeah.
We think about the same thing. Yeah. Mary-Kate was like, that's the grossest part of the movie. That was the scene in the movie. She's like, that was disgusting.
Yeah, but deserved. It is, but it serves to set up the character too, of like, you know, to establish like what kind of like what we're dealing with now when it comes to Maxine, and like where she's at essentially, and that's fantastic. It also kind of like it's a good fake out, right, too, where we've kind of had, because by that point in the movie we've already had an on screen like giallo kill of like the gloved hand going and murdering somebody, and then the fake out then where you're like, oh wait, is this the killer? Is this going to be the guy that like is hunting Maxine down? And then it turns out, no, she's just fine. She can handle herself. And she, yeah, she stomps a guy's balls out. It's super fun.
I think, yeah, it's highbrow, lowbrow. stomps a guy's balls out, lowbrow. Highbrow, I think people just really liked that X and Pearl, like, you know, were an example of the thing that they were, like, themselves commenting on, and still managed to have, like, some, like, sort of like modernity around its perspective on these characters. Like X is a 70s, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre send up, but you know, the women kind of get to like, you know, the porn star survives, not the virgin kind of thing.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
To boil it down, people really like that.
Yeah.
And I would say that Maxine pretty much plays by the books. You're not going to get like a ton of like subversive tropes about Hollywood. It's a lot more like, this is how it works.
Yeah, there is sort of like a, because even in X, though, there is sort of like a final girl kind of aspect of it, right? It's just that it's subverted by the fact that they were like, you know, shooting a porno as the premise of the movie.
Well, and like the morals of the movie X just differ a little differently than the way people view like some of those early movies. Like the nudity and the sex actually serve a purpose.
Right.
And whereas like in other horror films, it's you know, it's titillation, quite literally. But that's like, oh, we get to kind of have our cake and eat it too movie.
Right, yeah.
And this one, Maxine, feels a lot more like, it's just like a lot of cake. I don't know if it's like, or a lot of eating. I don't know if it's a lot of cake. I'm butchering this metaphor. But I don't know if there's as much of the like, we can feel like self-righteous about this one because it's just a good old-fashioned killer, slasher, giallo, you know,
it is
thriller, and then horror.
And then the ultimate resolution too of like bringing back like the dad, right? The like the proselytizing sort of like
I call him the final boss.
Yeah.
He's the final boss of the X trilogy. Is like
it was, you know, yeah.
Like Pearl is like the chamber boss, and then there's like, okay, now you have to beat like the living embodiment of like self-righteousness.
Mm-hmm. And it was a boss battle too. Like that's how the movie ends. The movie ends with a boss battle. So.
Yeah, exactly. It's a great movie. I still recommend. That's the thing. It's a very approachable horror movie.
Yeah.
If people are kind of new to the genre, yeah, there's some moments you're going to be grossed out. But like, if you're not a horror fan but you want something to kind of sink your teeth into, like 100% go see Maxine. This is definitely going to be a great entry for some younger generation that's like not sure. This is like a slumber party movie at its finest.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's, and I think the action elements of it too, like there's it, pacing wise, like it you know, it's only 100 minutes long, right? It's like barely, you know, it's an hour and 40 minutes. Much like the other two movies, like it doesn't overstay its welcome, and it kicks along at a pretty rapid pace. Things happen in the movie, and it's, you know, it's exciting. And I think
things
that
happen. A movie has a plot, and it's
yeah,
very
the movie
cool.
has a plot. It is definitely a movie that is a thing. It's a movie picture.
I watched
on
the movie. Yeah. Yeah, I'm just more forgiving because I think it succeeded at being that 80s gel, like what we've been talking about this whole time. I think it succeeded so well in being that movie that it's made me realize that, like, yeah, if we were to apply this criticism to those movies, we'd also be a little disappointed.
I think if you take each individual movie by itself and assess it by those criteria, I think it does. Yes, this movie does succeed in that. I think the dismay, and I think a lot of people, maybe the sort of it's disappointment sounds harsh, but it's just the interesting sort of like reception of this movie is that Ty West struck out very like very boldly and very successfully with the first two movies. I think they were both such an experience and such a an interesting approach to encapsulating a genre and period style film. That everyone was very excited to see what he would do with, you know, with an 80s movie. And he does very well to make an 80s movie, but it's sort of...
too good of an 80s movie.
Well, there's that, I think, as the trilogy as a whole, too. It's like, I think some people were expecting, it's that syndrome, right, of like, you know, with Jordan Peele, too, right, where it's like you have such a good, like, product at the beginning of a trilogy or of a career, even, that the bar gets set really high. And seeing Ty West as somebody who has a really unique understanding of the genre as a whole, and then we're curious to see what he'll do with it. I think somebody, I can't remember if it was IndieWire, somebody else put it well, where they were talking about, you know, Ty West needs to work with, he needs to get a not crap property and through a not crap like genre or like filter or whatever. Like he needs to just like make an actual movie like by itself that's not tied to sort of like the mechanism of doing this interesting like period piece or like weird sort of like character study. Because it'll be interesting to see, like, because he's a good filmmaker. Like that's the thing. I think that's at the core of it is like clearly he has the skills to capture like the thing that he wants to do. And so it's like with a movie like this, you're like, all right, this is cool, but I'm interested to see what he does next when he's not constrained. And it's just sort of like working with the freedom to make, you know, whatever he wants to make.
I'm gonna do a little fantasy casting here. A24, at least last summer, said they're ready to expand into an IP. They want to buy out something. And the Friday the 13th has just been sitting there, right, for the plucking. And so a lot of internet speculation assumed they were going to buy either the Friday the 13th rights or something else. And if I had to guess, my fantasy casting, this isn't like, oh, it's going to happen, but I'm like, this would be cool. Because I think Ty West would make a great, like, first run at the Friday the 13th franchise. I don't know where it would go, but I think it would be a really good, like, pop horror entry that, similar to Maxine, kind of, like, budgeted out, like, a big, like, kind of your blockbuster, but not quite a blockbuster horror from a known studio that people just, like, associate with artistic independence kind of thing.
Right, yeah. That would be interesting, but again, I think that's still... Specifically for Ty West, like, I don't know if that solves the problem we're talking. That would be really, really cool, but
I'm just, like, pitching fun ideas.
Yeah. No, I love that idea, though, of him, yeah, of him helming an IP like that. Or, and also, bring back Kevin Bacon, too. Let's fucking...
Yeah, can we talk about Kevin Bacon's Southern Dandy? That man is literally, he's Jake from Chinatown, but from Louisiana.
Yeah, there's a lot going on there. That, and then also, that was my joking Letterboxd review, is the Giancarlo Esposito sort of... feels a little underutilized. I don't know, he's pretty all up in there, I guess. It's just whenever I see like Esposito in a movie, I want him to be like holding the movie down. I guess he does, though, like as her manager that's a really interesting sort of role for him to play, too.
I think Esposito's in like a great place where he can kind of pick and choose what he wants. I mean, I'm assuming, I don't know, maybe he can't, but there is if you're interested in a lot of Esposito performances that are new and not just like the level-headed, coolly murdering people kind of role, which he's been known to play recently, you can always go back to his early career and just follow like some of his Spike Lee days or like some of his other stuff. Cause he's played some cool characters over the years. You can get your fix, Travis. Don't worry.
Oh yeah. No, he's going to be in a Marvel movie, too, I guess, here soon.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, it's a brave new world we live in.
Yeah. Maxine, I liked it. I gave it, like, a... I think I gave it a 7 out of 10. I still enjoyed that. That's a good score, like, for a...
Exactly. Yeah. I would recommend to people. I tell them, like, go check it out. Like I said, like, yeah, go check it out. It's not a waste of a day to go check that movie out.
No, it's fantastic. As far as summer horror goes, that's great. We'll talk about Long Legs another day. What else is coming up horror-wise?
I'll text you after I see Long Legs.
Yeah, we'll get into it.
Alien Romulus is the next big drop in August.
Yes.
Which we do love the director, Fede Alvarez, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. He did not Evil Dead Rising, but Evil Dead.
Yes, the Evil Dead remake from 2013 that I really, really love. Like, that's the Evil Dead that it's, again, a big tone shift from the original properties, but a very scary movie where the most recent one, the most recent Evil Dead that was made kind of, like, leans back into sort of the campiness, but is also very graphic and, like, you know, a horrifying movie. But that 2013 Evil Dead stands out as a unique installment in the franchise as one where it's essentially a remake kind of beat for beat of what goes on in the original movie, but through a much darker tone. And Fede Alvarez definitely brought some...
He brought the heat.
Yeah, he brought the heat to that one. So I'm super excited to see what he does with an alien movie.
I'm curious. I mean, it's definitely getting a lot of marketing. I've already seen it, like, blowing up. But an August drop is like sometimes a bad sign for a movie,
right? Yeah.
And I'm wondering if they're, like, giving us the 1-2 punch of, like, heavy marketing and, like, a mid August release when like the calendar is pretty clear to, like, capitalize on it.
Right.
And like, is it going to have legs? Is it going to be the thing that people are going to go back and see, like, 2 or 3 weeks? Or is it going to, like, carry that more people will start seeing over time? Or is it going to kind of, like, one and done?
Yeah. Yeah. Because you're saying, especially the August drop, it's like they were worried that this wouldn't compete as well with some other, like, either summer blockbusters or getting into the fall season of, you know, like big movies are going to be coming out. That
Looking at the summer calendar, what do we have? We have two big movies. One is Twisters this weekend.
Right.
The world is beyond excited for Twisters. I think the entire planet is thirsting after Glenn Powell. That has been at least the most predominant actor in all of my social circles. All our conversations are like, how hot is Glenn Powell? And in California too, I get to be like, well, he's a Texan. Yeah. It's like, it's just one of the ones you want to claim. You're like, he's well, you know, we're from the same state.
Just saying.
Deadpool and Wolverine, which why even bother gambling on something like that? It's gonna make money.
Yeah, it's gonna be fantastic. I think I'm gonna see Twister this coming Sunday. I'm gonna go check that out too. We'll report back on that. One movie I forgot to mention too. Did you hear about, or we discussed, like, briefly, Watchers? Remember?
Oh, the Ishana. Is it Ishana Shyamalan?
Ishana Shyamalan, I think. Yeah,
because M. Night. All Another Horror has The Trap coming out, or just Trap coming
Trap,
out.
Yeah.
So it's a hot Shyamalan, I'm butchering these last names, summer.
Yes. Yeah. Watchers was interesting. It definitely, like,
I love that we're in the Nepo Baby director era.
Yeah.
Yes. Like, it's gone so far as to be like, now directors' kids are directing movies.
Well, it's like, I mean, she skipped a step, though, kind of thing, too. Where it's like, because, like, Bryce Dallas Howard directs now, too. But, like, at least Bryce Dallas Howard was acting for a while.
Yeah.
I don't know. But, yeah, it's definitely, like, I mean, it felt like a Shyamalan movie. It was kind of beat for beat. It's interesting. It was a Shyamalan movie, but, yeah, the I didn't expect there to be so much. I guess he does lean, like, the fantasy elements. Like, Shyamalan is, like, in many ways, like a poor man's Del Toro, right? When it comes to, like, the relationship with fantasy. Like the Village had fantasy elements to it. I don't know. And this movie, Watchers, is steeped in fantasy kind of, like, lore, along with some kind of, like, cool, spooky mysteriousness to it.
I had read that, like, people kind of forget that Shyamalan, M. Night, the father, is, like, really a very pulpy filmmaker. It's, like, kind of not lowbrow as in, like, insulting, but just, like, he makes these kinds of, like, fun, funky movies. They just happens to have, like, a serious style, which, like, most pulpy movies have to have before they get kind of, like, laughed around a little bit.
The movie has to take itself seriously. That's the fun part about it.
Yeah. People kind of mistake that gravitas in filmmaking for, like, intentionality as, like, oh, like, everyone kind of jokes about, like, oh, the M. Night Shyamalan twist. Like, it has to be, like, something stupid and serious.
Yeah.
You're like, well, that's how it works. That's how, like, those kinds of movies work. And if the movie were like any more successful, you would change your mind. Like, he has movies people are like, this movie fucked me up. This movie's like twist is crazy. And then he has movies where people are like, this is so insane. Like, The Happening. The planet Earth is killing us.
Marky Mark.
But you contrast it to, like, even some of his later movies. The one with, like, the two kids where they go and stay at their grandparents' house.
Yeah. Not The Lodge. The Lodge is a different movie. That's a... Yeah.
But he has movies, like, even more recently, that people have been like, this thing is crazy. So to have the kind of, like, hit-miss ratio of M. Night Shyamalan only says that, like, sometimes he's understood and sometimes he's misunderstood.
Well, I think the underlying, like, thing about the twists in some of the movies, too, is that the logic of the twist becomes so infuriating at some points that you're just – it sort of – it makes it impossible to even, like, enjoy or think about the movie in any terms other than just pure frustration.
It kind of falls apart under scrutiny.
Yeah, like a lot of those do, but
We're like maybe 2/3 of the way through the summer season, and it's I feel like I've been on a dry route. Like, it just hasn't been anything I'm like really in love with since maybe I saw the TV Glow, and before that Challengers. I was like, this might be my favorite movie of the year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at the Oakland Film Festival, there was a lot of really great the documentary features is kind of like a lot of what I watched there. There was a really fun first film called Booger that was really exciting that I called my it's American Werecat in Brooklyn. It's like a riff on American Werewolf in London, essentially, and so that's a really fun that was an interesting one about it's set in Brooklyn by a Brooklyn filmmaker. There was also the new Jason Schwartzman movie Between the Temples. That was sort of the bookend for Oak Cliff Film Festival, and that movie was fantastic. It's another kind of the whole theme of that movie is a lot of improvised dialogue, apparently. The producer came out and talked about sort of the building and filming of that movie leading up to it. But I would definitely highly recommend that. It's a comedy, a drama comedy kind of thing that is also very fantastic. But yeah, as far as horror goes, I'm excited for Romulus. That's going to this year. I think that's going to be amazing.
I will be seeing that in IMAX, no doubt.
Yeah. Oh, God.
With my AMC Stubbs membership. Join me, Travis. Join me. AMC Stubbs is awesome because they have this thing called Entourage. So you can, like, basically join a group of other AMC Stubbs members so that when, like, one person's like, oh, let's all go see this movie, we all have the Stubbs membership, like, they can check out using your Stubbs membership. That way we all guarantee seats together.
Nice. I was going to say, that is one of the things about the season pass that we had. You had to kind of, like, finagle the way you were like using it. Also, the geolocator on that was fascinating to me. Like, man, they really had the interface locked down where you couldn't pull up your ticket unless you were in the theater.
Smart this movie, one is you have to like show your ID when you walk in because they want to make sure like no one's just abusing the system.
Right.
But like I'm a very like normal dude. I'm just going to see movies at like 2 PM away from the Grove. I don't want to be there.
Yeah. One thing. Have you seen A Quiet Place Part 1 yet?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Okay. I'm sorry. We did not talk about this movie. Yes, I did go see it. Similarly, I was not as enthused as the rest of the planet.
Yeah. Interesting. Maybe that needs its own conversation as well.
Here's my fun take is, have you seen it?
No, I haven't yet.
Well, it's not going to ruin anything for you, but the fact that there's like a cat in the entire movie was so distracting to me. Like, I cared so much about this cat that I literally stopped caring about everything else.
Right.
You like it's like funny because they go through these big adventures. They're like being in the subway tunnels, and then like they get flooded, and then they're like drowning, and the whole time you're like, how long can a cat hold its breath? I need to know.
Yeah, that's I've heard that is the most like distracting element of the movie, is like you just become too invested. Like, whenever you have an on-screen pet, like you're really selling the pet's going to be the focus of the emotional investment of the audience.
And it's like there is a point to the cat. By the end of the movie, you'll like cry a little bit about the cat, but again, I was just kind of like, I don't care what happens to everyone else. Like, I'm scanning the frame being like, where's the wet cat? Is the cat okay? How did the cat survive this flooding?
Yeah. Let's set aside. Yeah, let's have a whole conversation about A Quiet Place. I'll probably see it here the next couple of days too, and then we can come back.
I'm a fan. I am just a huge fan of A Quiet Place. It's kind of doing the Halloween thing. The first two were two stories, like direct sequels, and then the third is like a totally different one. So I'm like, I feel confident in saying that like they're probably just gonna go back to the Emily Blunt family in the next one or something silly like that. I don't know.
Right. You don't think it ends with this one? You think it?
I mean, I definitely see a cash cow in this the same way anyone who sees. I mean, they're like remaking everything, right? So who's what's to stop them from just making a fourth and a fifth and so on and so forth?
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
And like, if I got that gig, hell yeah, I'd make like A Quiet Place Part 12. We're just gonna have fun with it at this point.
That reminds me. I guess the final Conjuring movie is scheduled to be released next year.
Do we really believe it's the final one?
I don't know. I don't know how long Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga want to keep playing those characters. Maybe that's part of it.
Yeah. I don't know. They just got to get a new house. Like maybe their grandkids are like 18 and going to college, and they're like, "Yeah, you know what? I got you. Let me make some USC undergrad money real fast."
Yeah.
That's a burn on undergraduate tuition fees and the movie industry at the same time.
we're intersectional here.
You're darn right.
So there's a couple movies we need to watch, a couple movies we need to talk about. We'll come back and we'll record a real episode proper here soon too. But hey, we flexed our muscles, our podcasting muscles. I'm gonna edit this. I'm gonna post it, and it's gonna be a real thing. This will fit nicely after the audition episode. No breaks in continuity. Everything will keep on flowing forward.
My goal is to just act like this, like we've been here this whole time.
I don't know what you're talking about. We just had a conversation a week ago, and this is the very next one we're having. So,
I mean, my entire life is different, but also no, not at all.
Mine too. So it's fine.
Yeah,
it's fine. Everything's fine. It's cool.
We're fine.
Everything's fine.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, I think I've podcasted myself into oblivion. My muscles aren't what they used to be.
Yeah, I know, right? It's hard to. Just wait till we have a 2-hour long conversation. We're going to be feeling it.
I'm ready to bring the heat, Travis. I think I'm not going to be able to give 100% every single time, but I'm going to throw some curveballs at you for sure.
Okay. I'm ready. I'm ready. Yeah. My baseball bat.
I'm going to start practicing my baseball metaphors. I'm going to learn baseball stats. We're going to do some great stuff. I have a lot of ideas.
It's the All-Star break right now. The home run derby was last night.
Oh, yeah. So,
your Dodger guy got it.
Oh, yeah. Anyways, I only vaguely know some of this stuff, so I'll be doing my research after this.
Heard. It's Sunday Scaries. It's a podcast. We have an Instagram. We have a Patreon. patreon.com/scarysundayscaries. Email me. I don't know. gmail.com or scarysundayscaries@gmail.com.
Oh, my God. We're not used to doing this.
No, we're doing it, man. It's plugs and everything. I'll have more plugs, too. We'll get that podcast thing going.
Cool.
All right, well, it's fun hanging out. It's fun hanging out, talking about movies. We should do this more often.
I agree. I'm all right. Aboard.
Let's do it. Cool.
Okay.
Bye.
Sunday Scaries.